this definition doesn't have much to do with religion. So it's not necessary to call it Islamic or Islamist terror.
The 20-year-old gunman, an Austrian with North Macedonian roots, had been released from prison in December. Apparently, he misled the government's so-called de-radicalization program. The main worry now is how Europe is going to deal with what experts describe as the growing threat of homegrown terrorism. Homolevsky, Vienna.
Palestinian journalists in the blockaded Gaza Strip have marked the International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists in front of the United Nations office. Journalists demanded an end to Israel's impunity and that Israeli leaders be held accountable for their crimes against Palestinian journalists. The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate handed a memorandum to UN officials demanding protection for Palestinian journalists. Since the beginning of 2019, Israeli forces carried out hundreds of attacks against Palestinian journalists.
Attacks against journalists are systematic and take place almost every day. Israeli forces target Palestinian journalists in almost every protest or event. Since last year alone, Palestinian journalists were attacked over 750 times.
According to human rights organizations, Israeli forces killed 43 journalists over the last 20 years. Additionally, hundreds of journalists were seriously injured, sustaining permanent disabilities that will probably accompany them throughout their lives.
The United Nations must come out of its silence and protect Palestinian journalists who are constantly subjected to Israeli crimes. Israeli forces have killed dozens of Palestinian journalists and injured hundreds more while others are still in Israeli custody. We call on the United Nations to help bring Israeli criminals to justice at the International Criminal Court.
During the Great March of Return rallies, Israeli forces shot and killed two Palestinian journalists and injured hundreds while they were covering the peaceful action. Palestinian journalists say they work hard to avoid being part of the story themselves.
We are coming under deliberate and premeditated attacks by Israeli soldiers during the peaceful rallies. Israeli forces killed two of my colleagues and injured hundreds, and I was injured twice while covering the protests. Some of the journalists sustained permanent disabilities.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye.
Israeli attacks against journalists have increased in recent years. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of Israel. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the programs To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام إذا هبت أمرا فقع فيه فإن شدة توقيه أعظم مما تخاف منه.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "When you are afraid of something, dive straight into it, because the intensity of abstaining from it is greater than what you are afraid of."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, one of the great lessons which we learn from Imam Ali alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, is for us to be able to read Quranic exegesis, or as it is known as Quranic tafsir. So of course it is very honorable and very good that we read the Quran, we try to implement the Quran in our lives, we try to read the Arabic part of the Holy Quran. But what is also very important, dear friends, is that we must try to understand what it is that the Arabic is saying. Right? Just reading the Arabic in and of itself is not enough. It is good. It is excellent. It has its own rewards and its own effects. But the next level, which really is the first level, is to read the translation of the Quran. And after the translation of the Quran, it is a good idea to read a tafsir, an exegesis, an exposition, a further explanation of what it is that we find in the Holy Quran. For example, one of the very famous exegesis tafsir of the Holy Quran was done by Allama Tabatabai by the name of Al-Mizan. So this is one of the things which we learn from Imam Ali. He tells us, and we find in history, in the history of the Muslims, in the history of Islam, that in the science of Quranic exegesis, in the Quranic tafsir, none could equal Imam Ali. Now, of course, we have to keep in mind that because Imam Ali learned his knowledge from the Holy Prophet, and the Holy Prophet's knowledge was from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, this is why they knew the inner meanings of the Holy Quran, as compared to other people who they might have glimpses of the inner meanings of the Holy Quran, but of course, because they are human beings, they don't have a complete understanding of the tafsir, of the explanations, or the in-depth explanations of the Holy Quran, as compared to an infallible imam, as compared to Imam Ali, alayhi salam. And so in his book, Al-Istiyab, Allama ibn Abdibar has quoted Abdullah ibn Abbas, the son of the uncle of the Holy Prophet, that when we were proved, he says, that when we were proved something regarding the exegesis, the tafsir, the explanation of the Holy Quran from Imam Ali, there remained no need for us to ask anyone else. Subhanallah. So we learn here how first and foremost Imam Ali alayhi salam, because he is connected with divine knowledge, because he is connected with the knowledge of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, who himself was connected with the knowledge of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we find that Imam Ali's exegesis, his tafsir, his explanation about the Quran was so beautiful and so precise and so perfect that great scholars like even Abdullah ibn Abbas didn't need to ask anyone else about this. And so we too, dear friends, should take a step forwards and read a tafsir of the Quran to try to better understand what it is that Allah the Mighty, the Exalted, is saying to us, a profound lesson regarding the tafsir of the Holy Quran brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
Thank you.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridvi.
Today is to continue that theme about the special fazilat of Amir al-Mu'mineen as far as knowledge is concerned, that he was recipient of ilm al-ladunni, God-gifted knowledge. And we saw various quotations from the experts of Arabic literature, as well as many Sunni scholars, including great personalities like Sheikh Muhammad Abdu Dui, Egypt, the Mufti of Egypt. They're all Muslims. Unanimously accord Ali that position of being Imam al-Fusaha and Sayyid al-Bulagha. He is the leader of eloquent speakers and the chief of persuasive orators. And so that status of Amir al-Mu'min is there. Nobody can take that. You know, people come, try to, you know, fight against it, but they are themselves defeated. And it's not Shias who have to do anything. This is the truth that nobody can deny. Even a person like Muawiyah, you know, felt bad when somebody was trying to flattering him by condemning Ali's ability to speak. One of the important collections, of course, is Nahjul Balagha. And this eagerness to preserve the khutbahs of Ali is from day one. Nahjul Balagha is the most famous one. And the reason why it has become famous is probably because of the purity of the intention of Sayyid Razi. Because many, many things, you know, people do, they do not realize if the tawfiq of Allah is not there, it doesn't work. And we see that Allah gave tawfiq to Sayyid Razi, that he, like many others, compile, you know, the khutbahs and the sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen, but this became the most famous one. Even though there were 22 collections with that title of khutbah Amir al-Mu'mineen before Sayyid Razi.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On the news line.
Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden has been declared the winner of the bitterly divisive U.S. election, denying President Donald Trump a second term in the White House. Several U.S. news networks, including the Associated Press, CNN, and Fox News, made the call after Biden increased his lead in the battleground state of Pennsylvania, with vote counting still ongoing in several states. His win in Pennsylvania gave him enough electoral votes needed to enter the White House. His supporters poured into the streets in front of the White House in Washington, D.C., and several other cities across the country to celebrate the victory. However, the election results represent a widening rift in the American society. Even though Joe Biden received over 75 million votes, breaking the record for more popular votes than any other president in U.S. history, President Donald Trump managed to garner more than 70 million votes.
There's growing political division in the United States to a level that hasn't been seen in a really long time. You have crumbling infrastructure across the country. You have rising unemployment. They're talking about a second and third lockdown in the United States. The economic situation is really dire. And so two wings of the ruling parties in the United States are fighting against each other.
Many observers had anticipated that the outcome of the election would be disappointing for either side if the other secured victory. But the tight race between the two candidates shows how polarized the American public has become. Outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump has repeatedly made allegations of election fraud and vowed to challenge the results in court.
And there are many instances which will be reported very shortly. There's tremendous litigation going on. And this is a case where they're trying to steal an election. They're trying to rig an election.
He has challenged the results in several states, including Arizona, where the president's campaign filed a lawsuit alleging that Maricopa County incorrectly rejected votes cast by in-person voters on Election Day. In a statement, Trump said Biden is rushing falsely to pose as the winner and the election is far from over. This is despite that a stream of heads of state have already congratulated Biden on his election victory. Trump's unsubstantiated claims about the election results and the possibility of fraud are adding fuel to the already smoldering fire burning in the U.S. society. Trump supporters, some carrying weapons, have rallied in several U.S. cities protesting the results and echoing the president's allegations of fraud, saying the election was stolen.
I think what this election has shown above all else is that the U.S. claim of being legitimate and democratic and having free, fair, and quick elections is collapsing. Nobody believes that myth anymore. And the fact that a country like Bolivia, for example, had faster, more efficient elections even after a coup than the United States just goes to show that.
President-elect Joe Biden seems to have recognized the threat. In his victory speech, he pledged to heal what he called a divided America.
For all those of you who voted for President Trump, I understand the disappointment tonight. I've lost a couple times myself, but now let's give each other a chance.
But how long will it take until he manages to fulfill his promise, if at all?
Outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump made it no secret that he was on the warpath when it came to China. Not only did he spark a contentious trade war with the Chinese, but he also brazenly stated that the COVID-19 virus was Chinese-made, sparking notions of racism, which, along with his disastrous handling of the virus in the U.S., likely cost him his place at the White House. It's therefore strange to see a senior U.S. Air Force commander stating that U.S. troops in the region should prepare for conflict in the near future, echoing tones stated by Chinese President Xi Jinping during a recent visit to a military barracks in China. In spite of the ongoing election saga taking place in the US, the Americans claim that the Chinese are taking part in malicious activities around the Pacific Rim, and in particular in the South China Sea, stating that China is misaligned with international law. Yet it can be argued that the polar opposite is true, as the US seek to provoke and agitate the Chinese by sending senior representatives to Taiwan, as well as stoking the flames in the recent tensions in Hong Kong, suggesting that if anyone should be claiming foul play, it's the Chinese over the Americans. It therefore remains to be asked as to whether the Americans are more eager to start a conflict than China, with the US already embroiled in a host of conflicts around the world, could the US then be seeking to start another with its greatest rival China, not only to cement its place as a world power, but also to stem the rise of the Chinese emerging as a threat to the US hegemony?
But I can say that for sure this kind of provocative statement, they come from the United States. They don't come from China. From China, there is no, basically no statement or will to provoke a war, basically.
When Donald Trump paid a visit to India, many claimed that the partnership formed between Modi and Trump was aimed at sending a message to another regional player, namely China. And it seems that the predictions were correct. The US has also expanded its regional and global sphere of influence further, as it seems that both Germany and Australia have joined the Americans and Indians in the region by performing military exercises in the area, clearly adding another US-backed layer of provocation towards China.
There are many countries involved, but from my point of view, I will say just the countries that are, for sure in the alliance with the United States. I will mention Japan, South Korea, definitely Vietnam, India, and Australia.
Yet with the election of President-elect Joe Biden to the White House, we may see the U.S. reverse its rhetoric towards China as Biden attempts to pick up the pieces left behind from the Trump legacy. However, there's one very worrying factor in the equation, namely that Trump still has until the end of January before handing over power to Biden, meaning that the unstable president may still have a trick or two up his sleeve, including the temptation of testing the very massive military that he leads. But as Trump finds himself on the way out, many of those surrounding him have also distanced themselves from the outgoing president, including a vital piece of the conflict puzzle, Defense Secretary Mark Esper, who has prepared his resignation letter for Trump. But for now, it's probably safe to say that all attention has been diverted away from a conflict between the US and China as the Americans enter a transition period, and Biden waits with anticipation to tell Trump, "You're fired."
Israel is undoubtedly an opportunist regime. It once again proved that this week when it escalated demolitions of Palestinian homes as international media were focused on the presidential election in the United States. On Tuesday, the Israeli army carried out the biggest demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank for a decade. It razed to the ground the homes of nearly 80 Palestinians, mostly children, in the Bedouin village of Herbet Homsa in the Jordan Valley. The Israeli army made sure that nothing was left of the Palestinian structures, which included homes, animal shelters, and solar panels. Palestinians say they had no idea what was about to happen to their homes. The Israelis moved in without prior notice and gave them 10 minutes to evacuate before they started bulldozing. These families are now left homeless and have nowhere to go. Vehicles and tractors belonging to the Palestinians were also taken away. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shataya denounced the latest Israeli crime in the occupied territories. Shataya urged the international community to intervene against Israel's attempt to displace the citizens of the Bedouin village and tens of similar Palestinian communities from their homes and lands. The Palestinian premier highlighted the fact that Israel chose Tuesday night to carry out the demolition because global attention was focused on the high-profile vote in America. The demolition drew condemnation from the United Nations and the European Union. So far this year, 689 Palestinian structures have been razed to the ground across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. The UN says the number is more than the figures in any full year since 2016. Meanwhile, the European Union has highlighted the fact that over 50 Palestinian schools are currently under the threat of Israeli demolition. The Israeli army routinely destroys Palestinian structures in the occupied territories. Anything built without hard-to-get permits, rarely issued by Israel, is at risk of demolition by the Israeli army. Demolition of Palestinian structures and expansion of Israeli settlements are unending. Israeli settlements have been mushrooming in the occupied territories over the past decades. Widespread international condemnation has failed to dissuade the regime from such actions. Pro-Palestinian activists believe even the toughest verbal denunciation do very little to stop such violations of international law. They want the United Nations, the European Union, and other organizations to use their economic leverage with Israel to force the regime to halt its illegal action.
Well, the majority of the EU's exports to the illegal Zionist entity actually come through settlements. So while the EU issues a lot of condemnation of Israel over its illegal settlements, it needs to really put its condemnation into practice by withdrawing from a lot of its economic and bilateral agreements.
Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today as several Arab states are abandoning the Palestinian cause and normalizing their ties with Israel. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. As many governments refuse to pressure the regime, Palestinians are hoping popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day bear fruit.
European countries are announcing varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte announced a 6 p.m. curfew for the country's restaurants and cafes, calling for national unity. He said the restrictions can be eased if the infection curve is kept under control. French President Emmanuel Macron decreed a new national lockdown lasting until at least the 1st of December. He warned that the second wave of the outbreak in the country can prove to be even deadlier than the first. In Belgium, Prime Minister Alexander De Croo expressed hope that a team of 11 million citizens would come together in following more stringent regulations. The United Kingdom has also joined the countries that have announced nationwide lockdowns for the second time.
And so now is the time to take action because there is no alternative. And from Thursday until the start of December, you must stay at home. You may only leave home for specific reasons.
Boris Johnson added that all non-essential retail stores will close down, but there would be no need for citizens to stock up.
Things are very bad in Europe at the moment. The general mass of the population has lost confidence in their government because of their mishandling, and I would say even criminal negligence surrounding COVID-19 since the beginning. China, for example, went on full lockdown on January the 23rd for 6 weeks and is now on top of it. Normal life has returned, and the economic growth for which China is well known has been restored because China had what's called a full lockdown.
The stringent measures come as the country's confirmed COVID-19 infections exceeded 1 million, with over 20,000 cases being reported daily. The economic fallout of the coronavirus pandemic, massive layoffs, and rising unemployment levels in Europe have added to already lingering concerns about public health. The mayors of 9 cities have bypassed their national governments to write directly to the president of the European Council, Charles Michel, demanding access to the €750 billion EU recovery fund. Protesters from across the continent are calling on their governments to provide greater financial support to those hit worst by the pandemic. In Italy, a tipping point appears to be disturbingly close. Angry demonstrations erupted in Naples just over a week ago after a local curfew was imposed. The protests were followed by a civil order in Milan and Turin, where luxury stores were looted. A poll following last week's mini-riots found that over three-quarters of Italians believe there will be more violence in the streets this winter. Experts also believe it is quite likely that countries like France that witnessed unprecedented strikes and protests before the pandemic even began face serious social unrest.
The potential economic damage from the virus and from new lockdowns is of course very considerable. Already we've seen European economies shrink at times during this year, and several governments, including the British government, have introduced financial schemes to help companies keep people employed. So, for example, here in Britain, we've had what's called a furlough scheme, where companies are paid 80% of workers' wages while they are in fact at home, not working. But of course, that would be very, very expensive for the country, and Britain and other countries in Europe are running up huge debts and deficits, which will have to be paid off one day.
The stakes were remarkably high before the first lockdowns were imposed back in March, but they may be even higher now. In yet another embarrassment for the US government, new evidence has come to light that a plot aimed at overthrowing the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has shown that the very highest echelons of Washington were aware of what was about to happen, as the plans appear to have been conceived in a Trump-owned complex. The apparent coup plot was instigated in the so-called Trump Doral, a golf course in Florida, where the alleged perpetrators of the act met on the green grass of the 12th fairway, planning to overthrow Nicolas Maduro while circumnavigating the bunkers of the golf course in the process. The failed coup saw dozens of people arrested by Venezuelan forces, with many of the detained being US citizens and having links to the US-backed Juan Guaido, hence proving that the US are more than certainly involved in the plot. The clear failure by the mercenaries to overthrow Maduro in the coup shows that in spite of having one of the world's largest military forces, as well as having an almost blank checkbook funded by the CIA, the Americans have a long way to go before they are able to upstage any government in South America, or for that matter, anywhere else in the world, suggesting that the US attempt to fund a coup in Venezuela is a clear failure and an embarrassment for the Americans.
Yeah, absolutely does. It's a catastrophic failure. Just an utterly sort of laughable, pathetic, you know, Bay of Piglets, as it was referred to by many. Not a really terribly serious seeming coup attempt in terms of what the United States has done in the past, but a coup attempt nonetheless. Absolutely, Trump administration's fingerprints are all over this, although officially Vice President Pence has described this lawsuit that we see now from Jordan Goudreau, who is sort of in charge of plotting this coup and signing it with would-be sort of pseudo-president Juan Guaido, who is in fact obviously not the president of any sovereign territory or country.
Yeah, as with multiple lies delivered by the US and their failed foreign policy attempts, the embarrassing failure in Venezuela is yet another notch that the US can add to their miseries when trying to destabilize any nation around the world, especially a nation that's shown the ability and skill to resist, much to the shame of Washington. It seems that the US does not seem to care whether it succeeds or fails when it comes to its foreign policies, with example after example showing that failure is a part and parcel of the US statecraft that we've all seen over the last few decades. So-called intelligence leads in the past have all shown how the lies justified by the Americans and their allies have all come to no results, and have left all the decision makers at the top very red-faced in the process, with one such example of seeing the Saddam regime in possession of weapons of mass destruction. This is clearly the best example of them all. But in spite of the clear failures demonstrated by the US and its proxies, the fact that they can continue as if nothing had happened in the first place is something that needs to be addressed. Yet is something that appears to be just another story brushed under the carpet, in spite of evidence clearly showing that the Americans were wrong in the first place. The question that now remains to be asked is whether the US are happy to live and let live when it comes to such massive failures. Or will the red mist settle in front of the eyes of the hawks in Washington, D.C., and mean that the U.S. will seek to gain revenge in the future in ever more harder and brutal ways?
Although I am generally hesitant to draw any real distinction between the foreign policy of the Democrats and Republicans in the sense that they both sort of ultimately want similar things, which is to say, U.S. domination of the world's people and resources. There may be some differences here in terms of the presidential election in the United States. Donald Trump obviously is playing to a very far-right fringe of Venezuelans, wealthy elite Venezuelans who live in Florida. These people are not representative, of course, of any of the normal Venezuelan population, nor are they representative of the normal Florida population.
The truth of the matter is, however, that the attempted coup in Venezuela, for example, is nothing more than an easily deniable event of the past, and is something that, like many other US-backed destabilizing techniques, will remain nothing more than a story gracing the pages of Wikipedia, hence allowing the US to continue their calamitous foreign policies, safe in the knowledge that the denial policy is always best, and that any stories that do eventually emerge will never be acted upon.
In the limelight.
Capture a variety of opinions in the 2020 U.S. presidential race. Reuters news agency spoke to 42 women in 12 states. Arizona, Florida, Nevada, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, Ohio, Nebraska, and Indiana. Where voters swung for and against Donald Trump. Some once stalwart Republicans told Reuters they had, for the first time, crossed party lines to vote for Joe Biden. Some were young, first-time voters, selecting Biden only because they saw the alternative as far worse. Others, whether Republican or Democrat, said they had never liked or voted for Trump. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Michael Rosenberg, Gabriella Borter, PJ Hubstutter, Mimi Dwyer, and Chris Kahn. The piece is titled, I Just Couldn't Be Silent, How American Women Decided 2020 Presidential Race. The article has been taken from the Reuters news agency. Please stay with us for more. Grace Badala's 82-year-old mother had been a fan of President Donald Trump since his days hosting the reality TV show The Apprentice. She enthusiastically voted for Trump in 2016. But in the first weeks of the coronavirus pandemic, as the two watched daily White House briefings, Badala's mom, Grace Weber, voiced her first doubts. Badala, a 48-year-old home care nurse, recalled Weber asking, why isn't he listening to the medical experts? Weeks later, Weber landed in the hospital with a gastrointestinal bleed. She soon contracted the coronavirus, spending nearly a month on a ventilator. In May, Badala said goodbye to Weber over FaceTime, clutching her mother's rosary beads. Badala, who lives in a suburb of Scranton, Pennsylvania, had been a Republican all her life. But she concluded, Trump lacked the integrity and trustworthiness and responsibility she was raised to value, and she wanted him out. She became a prominent booster of Trump's Democratic rival, even agreeing to appear in an online advertisement for former Vice President Joe Biden's campaign. She said, I just couldn't be silent on this one. I let my mom's voice be heard. Women appear to have been crucial in delivering the U.S. presidency to Joe Biden. They were at the forefront of the highest U.S. voter turnout in at least a century, casting ballots at higher rates than men. And according to exit polls from Edison research firm, more than half of female voters, 56%, chose the former vice president compared to 48% of men. Media outlets called the race for Joe Biden on Saturday after he pulled ahead decisively in Pennsylvania. wasn't just women who carried Biden. Donald Trump lost ground among male voters in 2020 compared to 2016. But key to Joe Biden's success were his gains among white college-educated women in battleground states, women like Vidala, who turned out in high numbers than for Trump's Democratic rival Hillary Clinton 4 years ago. African-American women, and to a lesser degree, Latinas, supported Biden's bid for the White House over Trump by wide majorities nationally, and more so than African-American and Latino men. Trump has not conceded the race, even as Biden's lead in the vote tally rises. Recounts appear likely in states where the margin is narrow, but Donald Trump would need to overturn the results in at least three states to prevail. Trump's court battles, too, are widely seen as unlikely to change the outcome of the elections. Trump's difficulties in appealing to women voters long predate this election and the pandemic. Accusations of sexual harassment and assault have dogged him for years. The day after Trump's 2017 inauguration, hundreds of thousands of people protested his election in a women's march in Washington, D.C. and other cities around the country. Still, Donald Trump held strong with one female demographic across both elections, white women without college degrees, including some of Vidala's relatives in Pennsylvania. To capture a variety of opinions in the 2020 race, Reuters news agency spoke to 42 women in 12 states: Arizona, Florida, Nevada, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, Ohio, Nebraska, and Indiana, where voters swung for and against Donald Trump. Some once stalwart Republicans told Reuters they had, for the first time, crossed party lines to vote for Joe Biden. Some were young, first-time voters, selecting Biden only because they saw the alternative as far worse. Others, whether Republican or Democrat, said they had never liked or voted for Donald Trump. Among Trump supporters, some women were fans whose votes and organizing on his behalf helped him to outperform expectations in several states. Regardless of their differences, many women threw themselves into political activism for the first time during this presidential campaign. Biden backers said in interviews that they were motivated by back-to-back crises of the past year, including the coronavirus pandemic, economic turmoil, and widespread protests against racism and police brutality. Paula McCabe, a 44-year-old of Williamsport, Pennsylvania, who lost her job at a coffee shop equipment manufacturer during the pandemic, said she was more motivated than ever before to vote this year. Paula McCabe, who voted for Joe Biden, said, "I've never been through an election that literally meant the entire country was going to crash and burn or finally thrive." She added, "This to me is probably the most important vote I've ever been alive for." Women in the United States have in many ways bore the brunt of the coronavirus pandemic and its economic fallout. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, they have left the labor force at starkly higher rates than men as they juggle homeschooling duties and childcare. According to Washington, D.C.-based Center for Economic and Policy Research, those able to stay employed are more often working frontline jobs, especially in medicine or social services. Reuters polling before the election showed COVID-19, the disease that has killed more than 245,000 Americans this year, was a dominant issue for all voters, but more so for women. The Edison voter exit poll said 52% of women voters said that Joe Biden would be better at dealing with the coronavirus, compared with 44% who thought the same of Trump. But views on how much the coronavirus mattered to their vote were starkly divided along political lines. 24% of Biden voters said it was the issue that mattered most to them, compared to 5% of Donald Trump supporters. The fear of COVID-19 was ever present for Denise Calloway in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, after she lost several friends to the disease. But her primary motivation for voting was different: the chance to elect Kamala Harris as the first female, an African-American, vice president. Denise Calloway, 64-year-old, said she cried when Biden announced Harris as his running mate. Calloway, a retired public relations executive and consultant, connected with the Biden campaign in Wisconsin through friends at her black sorority. She began canvassing by phone and participated in weekly Zoom prayer circles with other volunteers. Black women, who overwhelmingly vote Democratic and at higher rates than black men, were never big Trump supporters. But Reuters polling showed they grew increasingly critical of the president this year. According to the Edison data, 91% of black women supported Joe Biden, 11 percentage points more than black men. Racial justice issues were important to voters overall. More than half of all voters and 87% of Biden voters said they had a favorable view of the Black Lives Matter movement. These activists helped launch national protests after the killing of George Floyd, a black man, by white police officers in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Calloway and her husband raised their son and two daughters, now adults, in Milwaukee County, one of the few that went for Clinton in 2016 when Donald Trump won Wisconsin by under 23,000 votes, in part by citing decades of lost manufacturing jobs. Calloway, the daughter of an auto executive, says Trump has broken promises to bring manufacturing jobs to Rust Belt states. This year, Biden flipped Wisconsin back by almost as narrow a margin as Trump won it in 2016, unless a recount changes the result, which rarely happens in U.S. elections. Nationally, Biden overwhelmingly won the support of young people as a whole, gaining the votes of 62% of 18 to 29-year-olds. Young Latina voter Yasmin Sagastume grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, the youngest of five children born to a mother from Mexico and a father from Guatemala. Now in college, she became politically active whilst in high school. Sagastume said she is not a big Biden fan. She supported the progressive Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primaries and relates much more to 31-year-old New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez than a white male. Nevertheless, for months she made calls to young Hispanic voters encouraging them to vote. She said, "We're just trying to get Trump out, and that's the only goal." As the campaign progressed, personal collections frayed in a deeply divided country. According to a Reuters Ipsos Election Day poll, a fifth of American voters said they stopped talking to a family member or lost a friend because of the election. Denise Alton, a 46-year-old retired social worker who lives outside Raleigh, North Carolina, said her husband revealed on their anniversary that he had voted for Trump. Having worked with disabled people, she was upset after overhearing her husband's family, also Trump supporters, making fun of Biden's stutter. She says she found Trump's views and treatment towards women degrading. Alton, which was raised in a Republican household, but diverged from her roots when she attended a liberal arts college. She campaigned for Barack Obama. But never before has she been as passionate about politics. She had her Trump-supporting husband drive her around the country to put out Biden-Harris signs and, with her daughter, wrote postcards to encourage people to vote. More than half of college-educated white women in North Carolina, like Alton, voted for Joe Biden, whilst their support for Donald Trump dropped 8 percentage points compared to 2016. Even among rural women, one of Trump's strongest base of support in 2016, the president saw his margins shrink. According to Edison exit polling, nationally, Donald Trump won 54% of the U.S. rural vote, 7 points less than in 2016. Slightly more than half of rural women supported Joe Biden this year. One was Rebecca Seidel, a 37-year-old who runs a small, sustainable dairy farm in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, with her husband. For most of her life, her views viewed closely to her Republican father's. But after Donald Trump was elected in 2016, Seidel left the Republican Party and registered as a Democrat, partly because of what he saw as rising racism and Trump's protectionist trade policies. In the 2020 campaign, Seidel's concerns kicked into high gear when she and her entire family contracted COVID-19. She said her mum was hospitalized for 4 days, and Seidel lost her sense of smell and taste, crimping her plans to open a small cheese-making business. At a local farm supply store recently, she noticed a group of men chatting as they bagged up animal feed. None wore face masks, a sign to her that some in her community weren't taking the pandemic seriously enough. Seidel said, "It's become a political statement," adding, "Some people believe if you wear a face mask, you're not for Trump." Donald Trump has long commanded a strong following among white evangelical Christian voters, and according to Edison, 76% of them voted for him this time around. But that is 4 percentage points less than in 2016. Trump also lost Hyla Winters' vote. Winters, a 71-year-old, a devout evangelical and regular attendee of a Las Vegas megachurch, voted for Donald Trump in 2016, but over time she became disheartened by his attacks on the purported enemies. Winters, a retired college administrator, said, "His behavior is appalling. It's embarrassing. While she has not embraced the entire Democratic platform, she supported Joe Biden in presidential elections. She had been somewhat supportive of Trump's plan to build a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border, but was horrified by his zero-tolerance policy in which young migrant children were forcibly separated from their parents. She went online to find ways to get more involved politically, eventually finding a YouTube video on how to create a blog. In February, she started one, naming it NotTrump.net. As the protests against police brutality broke out, she reached out to a black friend to learn more about what it's meant to have white privilege. Winter said, "She gave me some homework, including some books and online resources. During early voting, she volunteered for 7 days at a voting site to answer questions and direct people to open booths. However, she got some bad news on Wednesday, 4th of November. She tested positive for COVID-19. She had been wearing a face mask under an outdoor tent, but she said some voters had no face coverings. Her husband, a Trump supporter, also tested positive. Whilst neither have serious symptoms, they now have to quarantine together." Hyla Winters said maybe they will have more time to resolve some of their political differences.
IRIB English Radio.